KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. When sorrows come, they come not as single spies, but in battalions. It's a line that, for me, that's drifted through the entire run of the series on FX, Sons of Anarchy. Its creator and the late lamented Otto is sitting across from me, Kurt Sutter. First of all, Kurt, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, man.
But that line really rings true for me, that idea of sorrow, of kind of an Olympian sorrow mm-hmm. that hangs over it. Mm-hmm. How crucial is that for you in terms of the way the show works?
It's interesting. I tweeted something yesterday or the day before where people were commenting on the episode that had just aired. And I just, at the bottom of the tweet, I said, FYI, Hamlet is a tragedy. You know what I mean? Because people were like, what are you doing? And I think so. You know, there's obviously a passion in this lifestyle in terms of freedom and brotherhood and camaraderie. But, you know, that at the end of the day, these are guys that are making very dangerous and deadly decisions, and that ultimately I believe that, you know, violence begets violence, and that at the end of the day, there just can't be a happy ending, no matter how noble the cause, you know, when you make those kind of violent choices, you know. So I do believe that, especially as we get into the final couple seasons, that there is a comeuppance that has to happen, and there is a tragedy and a tragic sense of, can Jax get out whole? Can anybody get out whole? Can they get out alive? You know, what is that? What does that look like? And it's, for me, it's, you can't just have a show that just feels heavy. So, as in life, you know, we do everything we can to either not face the sorrow, you know, numb the sorrow, you know, counter the sorrow, and, you know, and I think that's where a lot of the dark humor in the show comes. That's where a lot of the absurdity I layer into it, so that it doesn't necessarily feel just, you know, overwrought with a sense of, oh my God, it's all going to, you know, crash and burn.
I have to ask you, where did the name for the motorcycle club Sons of Anarchy come from?
When we were creating the show, I was doing obviously a lot of research, and my first name for the club were the Zealots MC, and you know, there was a sense of that perhaps that might have too many religious overtones, and I heard that, and we kicked around some ideas, but I like the idea of sons, you know, the idea of fathers and sons, because at the end of the day, that was a big component in the story, so I like the parallel of them being sons of something. And then a lot of it, quite honestly, was ultimately trying to find a name that wasn't already a motorcycle club, because you come up with a great idea and you'd be like, oh yeah, the Sons of Sons, and then you go, wait a minute, in Dubuque there's a Sons of whatever motorcycle club or Soldiers of Anarchy, you know. It's so some of it is just comes down to what's available. The original title of the series was Forever Sam Crow, and we got a little note from the Hell's Angels organization suggesting that they owned the concept of forever. Like, on their patch, they have forever Hell's Angels, Hell's Angels forever. And, you know, I have friends in the motorcycle and the outlaw community. I didn't want to get into a thing. So we ultimately let go of that. And I'm glad. And you know, what fell into place was obviously the name of the club became the name of the show. And at this point, I think a lot of other people couldn't imagine it being called anything else. So
yeah, I even thought that was the initial title, because it's so fitting, and it's so sort of, I mean, basically they create this kind of sense of emotional anarchy, so yeah, it seems perfect, doesn't it?
Yeah, now, of course. It was brilliant.
See, you back into the best things.
Yeah.
But what I find so fascinating about your work, going back to The Shield, is how integral betrayal is for you. Mm-hmm. The betrayals of these acts of sort of impulse, and then the repercussions mm-hmm. are felt.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. My first meeting with Sean Ryan for the Shield.
He's the creator.
Created the Shield, and this is back. You know, Sean was a baby, and nobody knew what the f- we were doing, and FX didn't know what they were doing. You know, and Sean asked me. He goes, "You have a minute to tell me without, you know, putting aside all modesty, and tell me why I should hire you. What's great about you?" And the only thing I could think of was that I said I write damaged people really well. And that wasn't rehearsed. That just sort of came out of my mouth. And I think that's really if I have a talent, I think it would be in writing damaged characters well. I think, you know, myself, I come from, you know, a somewhat tumultuous upbringing. And
where'd you grow up?
I grew up in, the very white suburbs of New Jersey, but
how very white, Montclair around there?
Clark and Rahway.
Okay. Yeah.
And I say Rahway because it just sounds tougher because the prison was there.
Yeah, but that's not where you're from. Okay.
I have a lot of drug and alcoholism in my family. I have that in my past, and you know, so there's been some battles, personal battles and familial battles that I've sort of fought and you know. I'm going on 20 years clean and sober myself, so I've sort of danced around all that stuff, and I understand the nature of feeling and react and remorse and repair. You know, that's sort of my life. You know, and I try to on a daily basis, like not have the react be so big, so the repair doesn't have to continue. But so I understand. You know, I understand the nature of that, and I think a lot of that resonates in especially in the character of Jax. You know,
say Jax Teller,
Charlie
Hunnam,
Charlie's character. You know, I've always had a sense of that guy being a guy who was way too deep a thinker for the world, but yet came from this very sort of violent and, you know, when you have a mom like Gemma as your role model, you know, there's a streak of violence that you're raised with. So he was this guy who was very thoughtful and had this, and probably way too sensitive for that life. Yet within him, he had that really, you know, he had that temper, he had that violence, he had that hair trigger, you know, response to life that often got him in trouble. And just by the very nature of that, you have a guy that reacts quickly and dangerously to things that happen in his life, and yet he's a guy who has a lot of remorse and thinks too deeply about the things he does. You therefore have a character that wakes up every morning with a tremendous amount of conflict, you know?
An enormous amount of guilt.
So I felt like that's a guy I can go a lot of places with. I can honor the lifestyle because he can get himself into violent situations. He can be a badass. You believe him. And yet those moments of quiet and solitude, or those moments when he's alone with Tara or his mom or some of his brothers, you believe and understand his struggle and his level of, oh my God, what am I doing? How am I doing this? Where am I going? You know, you could understand it.
It's a treatment. I'm talking to the bleep-worthy Kurt Sutter. He's the creator of Sons of Anarchy on FX and one of its late lamented actors, the Rosencrantz, if you will, of Sons of Anarchy.
That's very true.
And you're talking about Gemma, who's played by your wife, Katie Sagal.
Yes.
She has, I think, you built into her the understanding, because everybody, or almost everybody in the show, talks about loyalty but is incapable of it. Mm-hmm. And she seems to have, like, her sadness comes from the fact that she understands what loyalty is.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. That's very insightful. I think she is the one that understands it. I mean, they all sort of understand it, as you say, but I think she's the one that is constantly acting on it.
We should say her own idea of what loyalty is.
Oh, right, her own idea of what it should be or how it should be implemented and or what her expectations of it are, and then does sort of do what she has to do to see that it's adhered to. And sometimes it's potent and beautiful and loving, and sometimes it's really destructive, you know. And, you know, it's that whole, I wrote this character for Katie, and people ask me all the time, is it who she is or blah, blah, blah. And of course, it's not her nature
She's a musician. She's a musician. Sake. She's a singer, Bette Midler.
But you know, it's the great thing about it was that I came into that relationship with Katie, and I didn't have kids, and she had these two great kids who were babies at the time when I entered, and you know, it was the first time I had seen, and I don't mean to paint this awful. My childhood was not tragic, but I had a mom who struggled with stuff, so to come into a situation to see Katie, and it's like, oh, wow, here's how a mom, this is what a mom really looks like. Like that, you know, and to see that level of, you know, she's a fierce mom. And it was the first time I had really observed that up front objectively and was really moved by it and impressed by it. And I thought, wow, what would that energy look like in that world? You know, and so it superimposed the qualities that she has within her world onto a woman that lives by a different code. And so she did, in a lot of ways, influence, you know, who Gemma was and just has different behavioral patterns.
Let's hope. But I mean, she is often, even when she's being completely ruthless, she's often this kind of the center of calm for the show. Was mm-hmm. that something you got from her too, to use in writing that character?
I think so, yeah. You know, Katie, you know, I'm often the storm and she's often the stillness in that storm, you know, as somebody has to be. And I got that, you know, I think that's who she is. And, you know, it's interesting. I made the creative choice in the episode that aired this Tuesday, where she sort of gets set up, and I don't want to spoil if people haven't watched, but she gets set up by Tara, and it's a devastating.
We say Tara's Jack's wife.
What's that?
We say who Tara is Jack's wife.
Yeah. Yes, Jack's wife. Yes, and it's such a brutal betrayal, and yet the way I wanted Gemma to approach it was, rather than like feeling like betrayed or angry, she's the kind of woman that like the relationship with Tara was sort of push and pull and up in the air, and she didn't know where it was at or what she was doing. And now, even as brutal as the betrayal is, she knows what the game is. I wanted her to have this level of calm at the end of that. So she wasn't like, she was just sitting there and you could see the wheels going, like going, okay, that's the game, that's the playing field we're on, and now I see where we're at. So there is that level of, you know, she's the kind of character who is, you know, in the chaos, she finds that sense of calm, like she feels much more comfortable in the chaos, and we really get that, and at least in the end of that episode and coming into the next few episodes, she doesn't approach it with a swinging a skateboard. You know, she really approaches it with a sense of, okay, now it's my turn.
Well, that's why, I mean, then I didn't want to get too specific, so, because I don't want to give things away for people listening to the show who are fans of Sons of Anarchy. But that, and specifically that episode, that recent episode, that sense of almost preternatural calm, it's almost like a superpower for her that she can't she can't help but have access to it.
Right. Yeah, and I think when you live that lifestyle and you have seen the level of brutality, you know, where you've been beaten by men
and raped,
and you know that you have to almost have that switch that you can turn off and on that allows you to sort of go to that place to get your strength, because if you live in the chaos with everyone else, you can't, you know, you have no power, you know. And I think she throws that switch and it allows her to sort of get quiet, and then, you know, and while everyone else is spinning, she can kind of put it all together and come up with the next right move for her, you know.
That's happening so many times on the show. We'll take a break. My guest is the creator and executive producer of Sons of Anarchy on FX, Kurt Sutter. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Welcome back, not to Charming, California, but The Treatment. We're talking about Sons of Anarchy with its creator and executive producer, Kurt Sutter. I'd ask you just before we got started, because one of the things I really enjoy about the show is there's a love of actors that's evident in the writing, and you can see the relish. I'm just thinking about how you could see the light in Jay Karn's eyes when he was doing it.
Right.
This is the last, until recently, I should say, Donald Logue. And you're an actor who started, but also you became a playwright, you were saying, right? And you did a lot of Israel Horovitz. And that sort of sense of conflict and trying to figure out what family is really key to Israel Horovitz.
Yeah, I started out as an actor. I was a member of 13th Street Rep. And
hold your head up. Don't be afraid. Shout it out. The reticent Kurt Sutter. Yeah. That'll be the first time everybody said those words.
No, exactly. But we were talking about this before. It was I don't even know if it's still there, but it was the actress Jenny O'Hara. It was I forget her. It was her mom that owned the building, and she had this repertory company, and it was this tiny little space on 13th Street in the Village, and she had a relationship with Israel Horovitz, and could do his plays without paying royalties. So there was always a Horovitz play in repertory. And so I did, I think I did, when I first showed up, I did Indian Wants the Bronx, and then I did Line for, like, I must have done 300 performances in every character of that play. And, I love acting, I love actors, and, you know, I went back with my mentor in New York, Catherine Gately, and who I studied with as an actor, and went back with her to Northern Illinois University and got my MFA. And my plan was to teach acting and direct theater, and then started writing, as I said, really bad, unproducible plays in graduate school.
When you say unproducible, were they unproducible?
My heroes were the poetic realists. You know, I loved all the crazy ones, you know, Strindberg and Chekhov, and, you know, all the really depressed, angst-ridden, you know.
Is that why
Ibsen.
You named the town Charming? Because it fits into that.
Yeah. So I just, you know, there was just, I had a couple of one acts that were just so heavy and you know, there were people would get through 20 pages and be like, what am I reading, you know? And and then it was really it was in grad school that I started writing screenplays as well, and that's sort of, I've written one screenplay that sort of became ultimately the thing that got me some attention and got me some meetings, and then when I graduated, came back to Los Angeles and really started focusing just on the writing.
But you do realize that Charming could almost be a name of a town in Strindberg. You do know that.
Yeah, I do. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that sort of, that kind of Strindbergian conflict,
right,
is very much sort of, especially in the scenes with Gemma and Tara, and that could almost be right out of Strindberg.
And that was my love of the absurd, too. Peter Weller, who's an actor and director of my show, just has this whole parallel, you know, theater of the absurd thing that he thinks the show is, which it's not that far, but there is that level of the absurd that kind of lives and breathes in those plays.
Well, the brutality puts on a level of absurdity.
Yeah, that allows you to, for me, what it does is it gives you a little bit of, it gives you enough distance so that it's not too real, you know what I mean? And that was one of the things that, you know, I have a lot of friends in the outlaw world and I understand their lifestyle, but it's a heavy lifestyle. And I knew if it was point for point realistic, that ultimately it would just not be an enjoyable show to watch, you know? It's not the kind of subculture that has the glamour and the inherent sophistication that, like, the mob does, or, you know, it's a gritty and sometimes unpleasant world, and
the word outlaw really, and all those the old world implications really applies to those.
It really does. And I love the guys I know in that life, and you know, most of them are just hardworking dudes trying to get by, but it's you know, so I knew I had to infuse, you know, some of the dark humor and some of the absurdity into it that gave it some breathing room and some distance so that you could believe it and enjoy the show and know that it's real, but you were far enough away from it that you didn't ultimately just want to blow your brains out at the end of every episode, you know?
The violence is absurd. Even the characters who are targeted, you're thinking back to the first season, and Don, you go, wait, what?
Yeah,
how did that happen?
Right.
And it's just, you, from the outset, you said, this is not the hyper-real world of The Shield.
That's right.
This is, in fact, two steps past that.
It, exactly. And in my mind, it really had to be. And it's like I always joke about how, you know, we just love to blow shit up on my show. And that's part of, oops, sorry, stuff up.
You're not sorry.
Yeah, I keep forgetting. But it's part of the uberness of it all. You know what I mean? And I think I, you know, sometimes I get hammered by the critics by that because they see that as, you know, they want it to be something else. They want it to be Breaking Bad, or they want to put it in that box of, well, it has to be real or something like that. And I'm very aware that I'm creating entertainment. You know, I'm very aware of an audience. I think it's because of theater. And I think because of that, you know, I'm not up in my ivory tower spitting out my art saying, world be damned, this is my art. You know, it's like, I love the interaction of an audience. You know, for me, it's part of the rush. It's why I'm so active in social media, because, you know, I want to be sitting in the audience watching the reaction of people. You know, that's part of the process for me, is part of the give and take of the artist and the fan kind of a thing.
It's the treatment, I guess, we just derided art while name-dropping Ionesco is Kurt Sutter. He's the creator and executive producer of Sons of Anarchy, which is on FX now in the sixth season. But you have to have a sense of the absurd and of grandeur if you're casting Ron Perlman as Clay.
That's right. Yeah.
He basically comes with irony as an armor, and he's bigger than life in almost every respect.
Yes. And you know, it's interesting, and I've talked about it now a few times, and he's actually a friend of mine, but we had originally cast Scott Glenn in that role as Clay. In the original pilot, we had Scott Glenn, who's a tremendous actor, but what ended up happening was, I think Scott, and I don't know how else to say this, but he was almost too real, you know, and he was very simple, and I really needed Clay to be kind of bigger than life. And we needed a guy who had in a realistic way, you know, if you look at some of these guys that came out of that world or any other, you know, the big mobsters, you know, they're very big personalities. You have to be a big personality. So we, you know, John Landgraf and I, who's the president of FX, and we put together a short list of who we wanted in the role. And at the top of both of our lists was Ron. You know, so there was really no other discussion. And I had lunch with Ron, and we talked about it, and he was interested. And we reshot about 80% of the pilot with him in it.
I mean, you basically, in Ron, because he has such a sense of pleasure as an actor, you have a kind of a combination in Shakespearean terms of Laertes and Falstaff.
Oh, yeah. We definitely tapped into the Falstaff of it all, especially when things got really heavy. You know, we really relied on Ron's ability to, even the heavy stuff, you know, to deliver it with a flavor that was real but not necessarily too dark, if that makes sense. You know, we had that whole interplay with he and Jax in that second season, where it was father versus son, that ultimately Gemma strategically waits to reveal what happened to her, knowing that she could use it almost as a tool. She could find power in that horrendous act and use it to her advantage and use it to upend that conflict, which is what she did. But none of that works unless you have two actors who make the conflict believable. So you have Charlie, who's a different kind of actor than Ron, who's a simpler and as almost like Scott Glenn, has a very realistic menace to him. And you have the dad, who's sort of bigger than life, you know, that sort of overshadows and overpowers. And then, you know, you just get this interesting conflict of the son rising up, trying to meet,
And because of that grandeur that he has as an actor, and that he invests in Clay, he seems unkillable. And
yeah.
Certainly, like,
yeah.
That's after you actually become the comedy of the show, sort of.
Yeah,
is
yeah.
That, is it the fact that he's, like, psychologically and physically indestructible.
Yeah, it's like you, and I just find that, There's some guys that they just don't go down, man. You know, they just find a way. You know, people are still upset that we didn't kill off Adam Arkin's character, Zobel, in season two. And like, when are you going to go? And my theory is like, guys like that just don't die. You know, they're like cockroaches, you know. They're just insulated. They have contacts. They just, you want them dead, but they just, you know, they just don't die. They find a way around it.
As we talk about this, for some reason, it just occurred to me. I thought about this in the first couple seasons. It just slipped away until now. I mean, I know about obviously Hamlet being the foundation for this, but often when I see Jax, I think about Oedipus, not in terms of his relationship with his mother, but right. The fact that he's basically responsible for his father's death mm-hmm. and all the destruction. He's the cause of the plague. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I feel that way about Jax as
well. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And him slowly having that awareness, I think, is really where the series is going. You know, this season, it's all about trying to get out of the gun business, trying to get legit, trying to do that. And, you know, and then you have and it's subtle in there, but you have some of the older characters, the older guys like Bobby, just sort of sitting back, realizing that that's probably not possible. You know, how, you know, can you be an outlaw organization and not be an outlaw organization? And it's what happens when you are a integral part of an outlaw community with a supply and a demand and relationships, and you decide to unplug. Like, then what happens to the community you're unplugging from and your relationship with all those people, you know? And it's like being in any other business situation. If you sort of pull yourself and your product and, you know, it upsets the balance. And I don't think Jax particularly has a big picture view of that. He's so, you know, myopic and so focused on, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get us out. I'm going to save us. I'm going to save us. I'm going to save us, without taking a step back and looking at perhaps the big picture of what all that means. And that'll slowly unfold as the season continues.
Is that, getting back to going back to Horvitz again, is that robbing your characters of perspective something that's been integral to the way you thought of the show? Because everybody lacks it.
I think so. I think Jax especially. I think what happens is you're driven by what you think is right. And you get very focused on, this is what I'm going to do. I know this is the right thing to do. And that becomes, you know, you get driven to do that. And, you know, and what happens in the first half of this season especially is Jax is breaking all the rules to do what he thinks is right. And it's Chibs reminding him that that's what the guy you hate was doing for 5 years. And look what happened there. Jack's insisting that he's not Clay. But, you know, the result, you know, the devices that he uses and the patterns of behavior are exactly like Clay. And it's, you know, so you know, he doesn't think he's Clay, or he doesn't think he's doing things for the same reasons, but it's the same behavior. And that behavior is what causes the destruction within the organization. And but yeah, so I think it is that sort of obsessiveness and that singular focus of, this is what I'm going to do, without perhaps having the wisdom or the ability to kind of step back and take a look at the bigger picture.
Kurt, I'm so sorry we're out of time. Will you please come back when you're wrapping the show up?
Absolutely, man.
My pleasure having you here. My guest is, sir, dear God in heaven, what show is he listening to? It's The Treatment. My guest is Kurt Suther. He's the creator, one of the late stars of his show, Sons of Anarchy on
FX.
There
are a lot of late stars.
Oh, my God. You do like a basically heaven or hell for all the people who've been killed off on the show. We're out of time. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenna Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. You know, I'm not on social media, but if you are, if you're on Twitter or Facebook or on iTunes, give us a shout. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.